Hi, Kelvin.
Hi, Ole.
We're talking about tetrionics in so many ways already. We were just talking about the Navier-Stokes equation, and I, in a way, I interrupted you and said, well, I'd really like to record this because you've just run into the Navier-Stokes stories, but I'd really like to catch you talking about your experience of this basically straight from the printing press, so to say, because science is all about that discovery tour and all about seeing how things can fall in place. And while you started to talk about your experience of the Navier-Stokes equations, your enthusiasm and your feeling and your connection to why are they doing it like this is so strong and direct that I'd really like to make it possible for others to experience and enjoy that as well. Because, of course, the Navier-Stokes equation is one of the famous equations in hydraulics, hydrodynamics. It's all about wave patterns, wave equations, wave conditions, which are normally described in terms of the movements of cycles and cycles within cycles. So Navier-Stokes tried to address that by having a system of equations basically to show how in one equation you can show the cycles, and then if you combine the equations you can do a kind of interference pattern by the mathematics of the equations. And people got very confused with that because the Navier-Stokes equations are non-linear. You cannot describe cycles within cycles and at the same time describe how the cycles change, because if you look at waves on the ocean, evidently you see that at some point the waves are longer, at another point they are shorter. Actually, if you look into the equations of the wave dynamics, the so-called orbital motion of the wave, you can see that at the base it is not a circle, but it is a vortex. So basically it is a point in the middle, it is a circle of a specific size at the end of it. And in the Navier-Stokes equation, there is an attempt to sort of see how you can go from circles from one size to the other. In quantum theory, of course, they also understood that, and they realized if you want to go from one, there they had it in a model of an atom orbit to another, then you must somehow go from a frequency of one wavelength to a frequency of another wavelength. So if you go from a wavelength n to a wavelength n plus one, there is this tricky episode in between where you are at the wavelength n plus a half or n plus one minus a half, and that's where you have the wave and the counter wave imbalance. So you cannot do anything with waves. They cancel out. Those are the kind of things where in the mathematics then they go into the, okay, we have infinities, we have zeros, what can we do now? It's wave cancellation. If you understand the dynamic of it, it's simple. So at one orbit you have a wavelength n, at the next orbit you have the wavelength n plus 1, right in between you have n plus a half, and that's where your phase and counterphase imbalance, you will not see anything. So in a Navier-Stokes equation, that's a tricky thing to describe because it refers to cyclic movement, cyclic motion. And in the Navier-Stokes equation, there is a way to describe that for the simple reason that cyclicity is then expressed in a mathematical term, and the mathematical term combines these wonderful mathematical symbols of the logarithmic number e, the imaginary number I, and the rotational number phi. So it is described as e to the power of I and phi. The I basically represents a time cycle looping forwards or backwards, which is called plus I or minus I, and the phi is a cyclic movement which is done like a stroboscopic image step by step, and you actually have to set the meter on it to know at which periodicity you're doing it. The E number, of course, is that of the logarithmic spiral, and as a spiral it's not cyclical at all, it's a vortex. So there you have the combination of e to the I phi, which is a combination of a spiral plus the circle of the I going one way or the other, but you actually can't see it because it keeps on spinning, as in this n plus and a half, plus and a half or minus a half. And then phi you can see, but basically it's meaningless because a moment later it could be anything else. So in the mathematics, that's the tricky part, where then in the Navier-Stokes equation, they can use that, but they cannot make sense of it. And I basically talk about this because when I was doing my engineering studies, wave mechanics, the Navier-Stokes equation, of course, was fundamental. And I also realized how little they understood the relationship between the spiral, the imaginary circulation forwards and backwards represented by I, and the stroboscopic representation of what happens, say the discrete formulation of it in the number phi. Because in mathematics, they are not often aware of the way they combine different reference systems. And so they are also not very aware of the way they combine different dimensions. And evidently, in the Navier-Stokes equation, it is a movement of a wave, which is what the phi part stands for. It is tracked in time, which is what the I represents, connects to. But it's also the spiral of E. But essentially, the spiral is at the energy level. The I is at the time level, and the phi is at the space level. So it is E to the power of I and phi, I times phi, is a combination of a formulation of energy, time, and space. And if in the understanding you don't make the distinction between that, you can really get lost. And you've just looked at at the Navier-Stokes equation. You've looked at the descriptions which you find in the academic theater, and normally they don't talk about the dimensional properties of the equations. Normally they do not talk about the difference between the logarithmic E, the circulation, the cyclic I, and the discrete number phi, which by the way also relates to the golden mean spiral at some level in combination. So how was that for you to look at the Navier-Stokes equation and then from the perspective of tetrionics essentially see it click in place? Because that's essentially how it seemed to work for you.
Yeah, exactly as you said, and you've even added more information to my knowledge base, because I hadn't even consciously drawn Euler's formula into the understanding of the fluid dynamics. I simply watched the university lectures where they went into great detail to explain the non-linearity and what they were trying to solve, the conservation of mass and momentum, and where Napier-Stokes fits into these fluid dynamic equations, what they're looking for, and the problems that exist, because no different than a gravitational field with Einstein's equations. They're all simultaneous. They're all nonlinear, and they're just frightful to look at, let alone compute. So they get the formulas. They know that Napier-Stokes solutions can solve a wave equation, if you like, a certain way and give them a clear answer, but it's deficient. Just like they throw Heisenberg's uncertainty principle in to say that you can't know the position and the momentum at the same time. Now, whether it was through ignorance or whether it was through my bloody mindedness going a certain direction with the way the geometry told me to move, I suppose that's for some historian to look at and have a few discussions with me, like you're doing yourself, Otto. Maybe listen to your discussions with me. But I went a certain way, and until you mentioned Napier-Stokes, as I said, it was simply a name. It had very little relevance to me. I hadn't looked at it, probably because it's in computational fluid dynamics and things like that. It's just a complex area of physics, which I had no need of. I could simply unify, sounds bold, but I could unify all of physics without having to worry about exactly what that name meant or what those names meant and how they applied. But you pointed out that the explanation was sitting there. So I thought, well, time to dust off the boots and go back and have a look at this. And what I found was that when you got a lecture, on Napier-Stokes, they immediately explained, well, in order to solve Napier-Stokes, you've then got to solve for the X, Y, Z vector directions. You've got to look at the planes. You've got to look at mass and energy conservations, momentum. And ultimately, what you're solving for is which way is the particle or the fluid moving, particularly with reference to, say, a frictional or a pressure gradient. Relativity went down the same track. It converted all mass and matter to energy and then described it as a pressure gradient in order to describe gravity as the supposedly the bent rubber sheet, the curved space-time. Useful. It allowed us to solve problems and to explain things, but at the same time, it was an explanation without an explanation. It gave us a way to get an answer without really understanding what's going on. And that's what happened with quantum cosmology. By the time I rationalized and unified and explained Newton and Coulomb's similarities and how they related to Einstein's field equations, merged the whole lot to give the unified gravitational field, the answer for Napier-Stokes was sitting there staring me in the face. But without knowing of it per se, I simply never wrote it up. So hence, if anybody's looking for it in my ebooks, you won't find it. But we'll have to address that at some stage. It'll obviously come up, no doubt, as we're talking about dynamics with biological systems as well. So perhaps it'll end up in that book or at least in a lecture somewhere. But the thing that amazed me the most, and this happened in general relativity as well, when you start talking field tenses and non-linear simultaneous equations to be solved, the mathematicians throw their hands up. What tetrionics gives us is a model that covers all at once in one picture space, time, energy, momentum, mass, and matter. So that gives us all the forces, everything physical and everything immaterial. So in that respect, the one simple basic foundational geometry of tetrionics must be able to explain all this work. When you mentioned Euler's formulas, the lectures I'd seen focused on the differential equations, X, Y, Z, and conservation of energy or mass momenta, solving for velocity. When you mentioned Euler's, suddenly another picture popped into my head, and that's work I have done on. And it starts with, and this is why the picture is worth way more than 1,000 math words, it's the key, because 2611, which is the basic quantum harmonic oscillator motion, is where physics, it's improper to say it went wrong, but it's where it completely missed what was going on. And the geometry gives us that key. We've discussed this one before. What is measured as a sine wave of electric fields or magnetic fields, or a complex wave combination of both, an electromagnetic field, is in fact shown in tetrionics to be the result of a 2 pi equilateral geometry, as in two equilateral charges back to back. As they move past the point, as illustrated in that quantum harmonic motion illustration, any person measuring or a detector in its place won't measure the equilateral geometries, but it will measure the strength of the E fields and the M fields and their position, geometric position, with respect to each other. And from that, as you measure those fields growing in strength, reducing in strength, beginning when others are starting, and vice versa, through the simple diamond 2 pi geometry, you get the complex sine waves of electromagnetic waves. Now, once you get your head around that, and it took me a little while to fully grasp that it's the motion of the diamond shapes that makes these sine waves as we measure them. It's not actually any sine wave. It's not a traveling wave like a transverse wave or anything. It is a physical, I hate to use the word particle, but it's a two quanta EM field that is a diamond shape that's creating these changing values. When you get your head around that, and then you look at an EM field comprised of exactly the same things, which are photons of energy, 2612, and I'm just going through these as a bit of background to lead into how we explain Napier-Stokes. The geometry of a EM wave is suddenly realized to be Euler's equation, or Euler's formula, however you want to state it. There's various forms out there, e to the I pi, e to the I phi, minus 1, or equals minus 1, the square root of it, these things. But when you look at it as a complex wave, what you see is exactly what's on, or if you draw it as a complex wave, Euler's formula becomes what's seen on 2612. It's simply, in this case, an electrical engineer would call it a quadrature wave. Four sine waves, 90 degrees out of phase with each other, plus and minus, north and south, all propagating in a specific direction. Now, I've shown in other bits of work, it doesn't matter whether it's transverse or longitudinal. In this one, I simplified it and just drew it as a longitudinal, where the linear momentum, or the square root of the scalar energy, is in line with the direction of propagation. For those that are new to it, tetrionics simply says that scalar energy that makes a force is an equilateral triangle. The square root of that equilateral triangle, which is its linear momentum, is the vector height, as indicated in pink on those illustrations. But here's where modern math, even though it knows all of that, and it knows that the E and the M waves are 90 degrees out of phase with each other, that's all in the math when you sit down and tear it apart. And Euler's equation's been known since the 17th century. It's best described by most mathematicians as the most beautiful equation in the universe, but they don't know why. It combines trig, it combines exponential features, it's got square root of negative 1, it's got plus and minus, it's got all the features of mathematics rolled into one neat little equation. But as to what it's describing, heaven only knows. Well, heaven's deemed to show us now, and what it describes is a equilateral triangle made up of smaller equilateral triangles of energy momenta. And it's that simple. So the question comes, as most people would ask, is Euler's formula, when you rearrange it, gives us a, you can express it in trig terms of e to the I x equals cos x plus I sine x, things like that. Again, just a mathematical rearrangement of sine waves, and whether we're measuring it 90 degrees apart, sine versus cosine. It's been expressed as infinite series, all sorts of things. So that's why it leads into it. But the question came up, which was what I was getting to, is that you can actually rearrange it so that e to the I pi equals negative 1. Because the first equation was e to the I pi plus 1 equals 0. So it then comes up, if that's the case, then you've got this square root of negative 1 being expressed using Euler's formula, or being solved out of Euler's. So again, the mathematicians were left struggling their head, because you can't take the square root of negative 1. Tetrionics says no problems. Square root is the height of a triangle. The square root of positive 1 is obviously the square root of a positive charge. So the square root of negative 1 is obviously a very real value, and it is the height of a negative charge equilateral triangle. And that's shown clearly again in Tetrionics and QED without me putting the connection through to Napier Stokes. Illustration 2613. And in this case, I was just out to show how photons, EM waves, and bosons of charge can all be related back to Euler's formula, Euler's equation. So with what Otto just gave me in his introduction, suddenly there was a connection between that and the waveforms. And the connection was back on 26.12, where at the bottom of the page, well, on across the entire page, but at the across the top, I show that the alternating diamond-shaped electric fields and the oscillating magnetic fields, dipoles, as you can see there on the right-hand top, are traditionally drawn as circles radiating out from a point. But in Tetrionics, we reveal them to be diamond-shaped fields, 2 pi photons. I split the electric from the magnetic, but then again, you can pick those diamond-shaped fields and look at the bottom right-hand, or the bottom drawings, and you'll see that there's a on the left-hand side, that there's a positive charge field and a negative charge field. E to the I pi equals negative 1 is obviously the negative charge field. E, it's exponential, it's growing, pi is the geometry, negative 1 is the charge. You can get the square root of negative 1 by simply taking the height, the linear momentum of that field. Likewise, there's a positive charge field with any EM wave or photon, which makes up the EM wave, and that would be expressed as E to the I pi plus 1, because E to the I pi is negative 1, so plus 1, so you've got a negative field, negative 1 field, plus a positive 1 field gives you a neutral, 0. Even though it's 0, it's only expressing the geometry. It's not stipulating that this geometric Euler's formula relates to Planck energy momentum. And nobody would have suspected it because nobody knew about the equilateral triangles that form the basis of tetrionic theory. Once you do know that and you draw that picture on the bottom left-hand side, you now have a full visual geometric explanation that completely explains Euler's equation as being, or Euler's formula, as being nothing more than a description, a geometric description, of electromagnetic waves. Simple as that. In the middle, at the bottom there, you can see that the phase arrangements of the fields, sine are electric fields and cos are magnetic. It could easily be the other way around, of course, depending on what the starting point of your measurement is. If you have a detector and the wave travels into it, obviously the first thing it will detect is the electric component of the field and then the magnetic. So I put it as cos for magnetic because it's 90 degrees out of phase and it's secondary to the initial field. Comes down to your perspective of measurement and your timing of measurement as to whether you see magnetic as cos or sine, and the same for electric. But the important takeaway point is that we have this quadrature wave made from the geometric photons and EM wave. The measurement past a point will produce that complex waveform, even though it's still just a sine, it's complex. It's sinusoidally varying in time. They're 90 degrees out of phase. The electric is 180 degrees out of phase with its counterpart of opposite, so minus charge fields, 180 degrees out of phase with positive charge fields. The magnetic appears in between. This is the foundation for Maxwell's transverse waveform, by the way. If you can see the arrows that are drawn on there, the vectors between the north and south dipoles, and if you were to move that vector instead of being equally split, write out and map it, you would have a normal transverse waveform that you see in everyday textbooks. Again, they've drawn the vector linear momentum and the vector E field and the vector M field. Had they drawn a vector dipole M field, their illustration would have been more accurate and they may have stumbled across the final picture that I have here. But they didn't. Alas, they stuck with the radiating concentric circles moving out in all directions from the radiative source. And if you look at those two fields for electric and magnetic as drawn at the top and place them on top of each other as they would be in an EM wave, that is what you'll get at the bottom right-hand corner. In the background, you can see the concentric ripples that traditionally radio waves and EM waves are drawn as. On top of it, or actually behind it, you can see the tetrionic version of the equilateral Planck energy momenta for that same wave. So if we were to wrap this part up, we simply say that, sadly, mathematics, although completely accurate, completely missed what the underlying geometry was that was giving rise to these the mathematics that they had. And in turn, because they did that, they developed this concentric pattern of radiating ripples of electromagnetic energy that then overlap as per Young's model of wave fronts to give us complex interference patterns and complex interactions of force to give us our the basics of field mechanics that then can be applied to Napier-Stokes. So from the very basics of a quantum harmonic oscillator, the picture, mathematically correct, was geometrically slewed to a completely wrong model, a model of radiating concentric rings and spherical point particles, whereas tetrionics started with the geometric equilateral geometries, probably a better way of saying it, and built from that. Again, it's this top-down versus bottom-up approach. But once you understand that that's what's making up all these waves, and it's not just electromagnetic waves, it's chem fields, which are equilateral fields that point in a vector direction. Again, they're electric and they're magnetic. They're made up of Planck quanta, all equilateral. They don't have two directions. They have one vector direction. They have linear momentum, again, the square root. They all apply, but instead of circular spherical wave fronts, we now have a situation where equilateral geometry is the king so far as what's happening at the quantum level for each and every particle. I'll throw in 27.21 just as a side statement to show one thing. I think it's going through. Yep. It impacts what's the word I'm looking for? This misconception about the underlying geometry, the fact that we as a species completely missed equilateral geometries as being relevant at the quantum level as a building block, impacts everywhere. And no more does it impact really harshly than in special relativity. The relativity equations, as written by Einstein, are all they're all the same as Napier-Stokes. They're all instantaneous, nonlinear functions. But what you see here in this one, which relates to the Lorentz coordinate transforms, or corrections is probably better, even that title is a little bit wrong. But anyway, it was right for this illustration, but wrong for what I'm about to explain. Relativity was based on Lorentz corrections. As the velocity increases, wavelengths get shorter. And I stress the word wave lengths get shorter. Material matter does not shrink with increases of velocity, even near or at or past the speed of light. And I was quite specific in those three types of speed. What happens is that the energy stored in the chem field, as I call it, which has a kinetic energy, a half mv squared, and a magnetic moment, a half mv squared, which makes the field mv squared. So any material object moving at velocity v will have mv squared quanta in a secondary field. It's kinetic field. It's kinetic EM field, hence the name chem field. And what I'm trying to get at here is that all the relativistic corrections, Lorentz corrections, Lorentz-Abraham corrections, transforms, special relativity itself, and even general relativity, which is founded on special relativity, relates to the contraction and motion and geometry of equilateral fields of mass energy. Matter, made up of the same thing, is not Lorentz variable. It's not affected by the speed or the velocity changes or application of force in any way, shape or form. All the energy of the force goes into these chem fields, and this applies in Napier-Stokes as well. But what you see here, and this is why I brought this illustration in, is right in the center, even though we have positive and negative charge fields, it makes no difference. They both are exactly the same. They are fields of mass, energy, momenta. And specifically, fields of motion or kinetic fields. So if we're going to model fluid dynamics and the pressures and the velocities that are created, how the wavefront moves, first, we have to understand that they're made up of equilateral, or that any force applied is made up of equilateral Planck energy momenta that is stored in these fields, not in the matter itself. It's a secondary field, not part of the mass matter of the particle itself. Think of it as the wake of a boat. When you push the boat away from the dock, the boat does not contract, but the energy of your push goes in and makes a wake on the water. As the boat speeds up, the wake gets bigger. As the boat speeds down due to friction, the wake gets smaller. Chem fields behave exactly the same way. The stored energy of motion is in that field. So whatever force you applied will be stored in that chem field in both a kinetic and a magnetic moment. And it will cause that material particle or boat to move in the vector direction of its linear momentum, as indicated there, the square root of the energy supplied by that push or force. Of course, if you know the weight of the boat, you can divide the momentum by the weight of the boat, and you find out how fast the particle will be moving. And more importantly, what direction. This is where we're starting to get into the Napier-Stokes now. Now, this one illustration gives us a bit more information as well that's directly applicable to Napier-Stokes, and that is, if you look at the pattern of, as color-coded there, of bosons in that field, you'll see that they form a normal distribution. That is, they go from red, orange, yellow, green, right through to violet, and then back across the page to the right, back down to red, which is color coding for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, a normal or Gaussian distribution of energy momenta in that field. That's where the quantum mechanics, the statistical probabilities come in for quantum physics itself. It all comes from that field and that arrangement of energy momenta within a charged geometry. Now, whether you measure it as mass, which is energy per second, as it's drawn there, or whether you measure it as an energy density, tau AB in general relativity, with its associated square root vector velocity or vector linear momentum. Makes no difference. You can even measure it as a function of time by watching the change of equilateral geometries or quantized angular momentum per second. If you do quick algebra on quantized angular momentum per second, you get square meters per second divided by c squared. Do the algebra on it and you find that you have seconds. Any changing seconds or changing angular momenta per c squared will give you time, because you get delta seconds. Delta seconds is time. Time itself is quantized. It's a measure of quantized angular momentum or energy geometries per spatial region. That's the simplest way to put it. It's another discussion entirely. But what I'm getting at is that all these distributions of energy quanta, the scalar, as well as the quantized Planck quanta that are illustrated here, and their various aspects of kinetic energy, linear momentum, magnetic moments, time, all these and all these features, velocity, can only be done in mathematics presently as simultaneous nonlinear equations, because they're a scalar function. The linear momentum, the vector, remain linear, but the rest of them are scalar functions. Even though we can now quantize them using tetrionic geometry, they're still treated as scalar, as you see up top, and as such, you try to solve for them x, y, z. Each direction of motion has to be solved with a nonlinear simultaneous equation. So just like gravitational fields, the mathematician looks at it and either has a stroke or shrugs his shoulders. To try and calculate all them is a nightmare. But to visualize them in tetrionics, as simple as looking at that picture there, you can see the electric and the magnetic components. You can see the kinetic components. The entire field's kinetic. You can make out its linear momentum by the diamonds running down the center, forming the central height of the triangle. You can see the vector direction that the particles will move in, that it's associated with. You can also see how many Planck quanta, E equals HF or H nu to be more appropriate in this case. You can see what that makes up. And accordingly, or more probably even more excitingly for Napier's side of it, or Stokes, if you want to go to the full equation, you can now bring in relativity. Because as we've stated that the kinetic field is fully relativistic, and it's the part that is Lorentz contracted or corrected due to velocity changes, we can now show that as you add more energy to by applying more force, you will put more quanta into that field, and those quanta being squeezed into that same geometric area obviously have to do one thing, and that is that they're squeezed in, so their physical wave lengths contract. As the velocity increases, the wave length of each quanta contracts. The particle itself's wavelength does not change. So in that case, de Broglie stretching it to the physical contraction of particles and Einstein doing the same thing was completely inappropriate. It was a misinterpretation of what matter was as opposed to what mass energy is. And that's where relativity has erred in its foundation. The Lorentz contractions, which gave birth to relativity, do not apply to matter. They only apply to matter insofar as the energy of the mass in the matter that makes it up, the mass energy in the tetrahedral geometries, has a specific Compton frequency and a specific de Broglie wavelength. That part's correct, but it's not Lorentz contracted. So once you understand that and what this pitch is showing, you can then take it to the final step, which I'll just dig up some... actually, 2801 shows the Lorentz contractions so far as bosons quite clearly with the associated energy levels of a photoelectron as it's accelerated. So it shows the physical contraction, the changing size of these quanta in the chem field as the photon, the electron is accelerated. And again, squared number for every chem field as the energy is applied. So this is where we get Bohr's quantum jumps, which caused all the problems in saying, how do we merge quantum theory in with classical mechanics and explain this contraction? How do we do all this in the case of fluid dynamics for all the particles that are in motion in, say, a wave front or of a wave crashing on a beach or a particle moving through some other fluid situation where there's resistance and things like that? How can we, in a macro scale model, we can do it mathematically, but how do we do it visually? Tetrionics gives us the answer visually, but it also shows where the mathematics was applied incorrectly. So we have that. So then from there, I'll just go down to where I need to get to. 84, the same chem fields, 8405, can then be redrawn. Again, it's showing the same field, same energy momenta, but this time it's focusing on the linear momenta, the vector direction created by those energy fields. The more quanta you have from the energy supplied by the force, the higher the value of the linear momenta and the higher the value of the associated velocity in proportion to the mass matter of the particle that field is associated with. Because mass is that lovely constant between force and acceleration. The heavier the particle, the slower the velocity, because there's more inertia to get moving, so the force will not accelerate it to a higher velocity or the same velocity as a lighter particle. So mass acts as the fulcrum, if you like, in the equation. But all the information about any particle in motion can be gleaned from the simple equilateral geometries of Planck quanta in a chem field, as can all the information about the charged matter topology of any particle. So now, using tetrionics, if we had a computer big enough and coded right, we could physically describe each and every atom, all the spare electrons, the energy in the system, the complete makeup for every type, whether it's a water molecule or a bullet, metal bullet in a water solution, makes no difference. You could model all the physical particles along with their chem fields for their directions of motion. Now, if it's random, obviously it just makes it more complex, but we've got supercomputers now that can model or do modeling for meteorological. We can do it for the weather. Meteorological, there it is. The brain goes when you get old. But we can map the weather. So, as it was once quoted, if you know enough information, you can predict their exact, not only the exact outcome, but also their exact position, energy, and momenta for any particle within that system that you're modeling. What we've been lacking to date is the ability to, firstly, have the equilateral energy momenta described as such, but B, build the topologies of the matter and understand the mechanics. Now we do. So if you were to build, say, a model of a 1 second snapshot of a system, you could then put all the particles with their chem fields into that model and then simply progress that like a still shot for another second. And that's all the Napier-Stokes equations are doing. They're solving for one instant in time. Well, trying to, because these are all nonlinear, instantaneous calculations they have to do, and they can't do them because they're so complex. But a computer can do them. So you calculate for the position, the charge topology, and the chem fields of every particle in the experiment under question. And then a second later, you allow that system to evolve, and you do another snapshot with the geometry. And you put a series of 60 of these snapshots together for every second. Instantly, you have a movie. And you've gone from a Napier-Stokes situation where it's just a black box to the computer actually running the simulation, which we can then test against physical models to improve or validate, particularly validate, tetrionic theory. That'll just about summarize it, I think, unless you've got another question. But I should add that all the problem resolves down to, as you were saying before, people have Euler's formula, have Napier-Stokes equations, but they lack the underlying geometry. They still think of it as circular wavefronts creating interference patterns, when in fact it's these equilateral geometries. And if you were to shade these as 50% coloring, you could lay them on top of each other as they interact. And that's what creates force between particles. Simply these equilateral chem fields overlaying, superpositioning with each other. And in the case of friction, all you have is a substance with its chem fields or its BEM field, more chem, but chem or electrostatic fields that are superpositioning with the chem fields of the particle in motion and resisting its motion, causing it to lose energy, emit light, heat, slow down, lose velocity. But given enough time with these basic geometries that we now have with tetrionics, we can do what Napier-Stokes attempts to do mathematically, but can't do, and that is to solve for a three-dimensional problem. Is it solvable? Yes. Can any of the fields resolve back down to a singularity point? Yes. Does it have the simultaneous equation component? Yes, there's scalar field geometries. Does it have conservation of energy mass? Yes. And conservation of momentum? Yes. From which we can deduce geometrically or visually the vector component of each particle. And then we just draw this situation, knowing the forces in motion, at much greater detail than you can with vector diagrams or math. And it becomes a simple visual problem for solving. If you want an exact answer, you just run the supercomputer for the length of time required, allow the particles to interact, and there's your solution. You can prove for a three-dimensional computational fluid dynamic example an exact outcome in three dimensions for any particle or for the entire system. Now, you can't prove that using the math because you can't solve the math. What you can do is manipulate the math by saying we will assume that there's no vector rotations, that there's only linear motions, so then we can get rid of all our simultaneous equations, all the scalar part. We focus on the linear vectors. Well, you can do both here with the tetrionics, where there's a vector straight line, linear momentum, you know there's an associated equilateral field of scalar energy surrounding it. So all these complex parts of the math with the curl and the differentiation over time vanish. It just becomes a simple slideshow of equilateral triangles. So that's how I would support solving Napier-Stokes' solution and showing that it can be solved. Whether mathematicians would accept that geometric approach will come down to how quick it takes them to accept the logic behind it.
Yeah, Kelvin, you've addressed two issues which are fundamental for the switch of thought. One of them is the relationship between linear and nonlinear, as implied in the Navier-Stokes equations. And the other, which is also at the core of tetrionics, is the distinction between mass and matter. And you've already, when you talked about this earlier, you said, well, what they are missing out on again is how they must set the matter part separate from the mass part. Maybe you could talk a bit more about these two notions, the separation of mass and matter, and the difference between linear and nonlinear representation in tetrionics.
Right, do you want to do it in this discussion or is this a separate one?
As it applies to the Navier-Stokes equations and the way they experience a complexity which disappears in tetrionics, it is part of this story. But for practical reasons, yes, let's round off this part of the recording and then come back to it.
Okay.
And take it up as a second story. But still, it is essential to the way that you are able to see the difference between the Navier-Stokes problem as it is discussed in physics, and for which they have put out this large money prize, and for the way that in tetrionics the problem actually does not exist.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I'll end the recording for now. I'll hang up for a moment and immediately come back to you. One moment, please.
Yeah.